Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Cancer is a genetic disease. Maybe you haven't thought of it that way, but it's a genetic disease caused by changes to genes, and these genes control the way our cells function, especially how they grow and how they divide. So these cancer genes, that these genetic changes that promote cancer can be either inherited or they can be acquired during your lifetime as a result of errors that occur as cells divide. These acquired errors are caused by environmental factors, things like cigarette smoke or substances in cigarettes and cigarette smoke, and ionizing radiation, are to mention a couple that are most widely known. On this program, we're going to focus on the inherited genes and cancer, and focus in particular on the inherited risk for breast cancer. I have two guests with me today. On my left in the studio is Dr. Ellen Provost. She's the director of Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium's Native Epidemiology Center. She's a survivor of breast cancer, and she's here today to talk about her story and also to talk about some other informational sources, educational endeavors that are going to be happening. The main guest will be Megan Nathan. She is here to talk about genetic counseling, particularly related to cancer. She works at the Providence, Alaska Medical Center, where she works along with another genetic counselor, Maggie Miller. And she helps people make decisions about their DNA and their cancer risk. I want to say thanks to both of you for taking the time to come and be with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Let me remind our listeners, you can reach us with your questions and comments in a couple of ways. In particular, the best way probably is if you live in Anchorage or close by, you can dial 550-8433, 550-8433. We also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And as you probably know, if you're a listener, our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Anytime during the program, if you have questions, comments, we'll be here for about an hour or so. Let's start off. Megan, I've made the comment already that this is a genetic disease. So let's talk a little bit more about what a gene is and how that may relate to cancer, if you don't mind.
Definitely, yeah. So a gene, it's just a unit of DNA, DNA being a series of letters that spells out the instructions our bodies need to make each of us. Each gene, it codes for a specific instruction using that series of letters. So you might say a gene is sort of like a sentence in a recipe book. Humans, we actually have 20,000 genes or 20,000 sentences in our recipe book. And our genes, they typically come in pairs. So one member of each pair would come from mom in the egg. One member of each pair would come from dad in the sperm. That's how we're a combination of our parents. And then when we go to have children, we pass on one member of each pair. And our partner passes on the other member. Mm-hmm. So as you alluded to earlier, all cancer is genetic in that it results from changes to a person's DNA. But the question I wonder with what I do as a cancer genetic counselor is, are these gene changes something a person acquired over their lifetime via things like environmental exposures, as you mentioned, or are they something that they inherited either from mom or dad?
And so virtually all the cells in our body have the same genetic makeup. With exceptions, there are unusual situations where that doesn't happen. And those cells do not live forever. They are dying. And so the cell has to reproduce itself. And that's where all these reproduction is happening. And we have quite a few, I forget, maybe a trillion cells. I don't remember. I'm not sure that's important. But there's a number, so many cells, and they're constantly reproducing. There is a lot of actions going on, and anytime you're doing that many actions, every once in a while mistakes happen. So that's kind of important to understand when we talk about how these genetic mutations happen.
Absolutely, yeah. So we have the DNA that we were born with that we got from mom and dad, and then throughout the course of our lifetime, there might be acquired changes to our DNA as the cells replicate and divide, so we can grow.
One reason why, as we live older, longer and longer, we may be more likely to have cancer. In fact, we're all probably more likely to have cancer as we get older because of slowly changes happen. But not all changes are bad. Not all changes lead to any problem.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
But some changes cause big problems.
This is true. The right change in the wrong cell at the wrong time can have big repercussions.
So why is acquired and inherited risk for genes particularly important, perhaps?
Yeah, so the difference between acquired and inherited genetic changes, that really is what defines the difference between two of our three categories of cancer, which are sporadic and hereditary cancer. So you mentioned that cancer, it's kind of a disease of aging. The older you get, the more likely you are to get cancer, largely as a product of the fact that that means that your cells have had to divide and replicate all that genetic information, all those 20,000 genes. And so majority of cancer falls into this sporadic category. If we can take a thought exercise and imagine whether or not somebody gets cancer as a weighted scale. If the scale tips far enough in one direction, then that person develops cancer. So in sporadic cancer, it's little life pebbles that get added to that scale. And these life pebbles, they look like environmental exposures, as we talked about, your cells having to divide multiple times throughout your lifetime. And when they divide, there's room for error since you're having to copy so much genetic information. So in sporadic cancer, over the course of somebody's lifetime, little life pebbles get added to their scale until in their 60s or 70s in older ages, the scale tips far enough in one direction that they develop cancer. Mm-hmm. That's the majority of all cancer. 70% of cancer falls into the sporadic category. The category that we deal with cancer genetic counseling is hereditary cancer, and that's only about 5 to 10% of cancers fall into this category. Mm-hmm. Now, if you can imagine that scale again, rather than little life pebbles slowly accumulating over the course of decades, with hereditary cancer, somebody is born with essentially a brick on their scale. Mm-hmm. So for them, it takes less life until the scale tips far enough in one direction that they develop cancer. When we talk about this brick and we look in families, we talk about this concept of autosomal dominant inheritance, which refers to the fact that with hereditary cancer, we tend to see multiple generations affected.
When you talked about sporadic cancer, the thought came to me that it might be easy to jump to the fact that all sporadic cancers are caused by environmental factors, and that doesn't necessarily hold if I understand it. So if we're making all these genes reproduce all the time, it doesn't have to be some extrinsic factor that causes the error. The error may be just in the natural thing. If I'm trying to hit a ping pong ball against a wall for 1,000 times, every once in a while I'm just going to miss, not because a butterfly flew by or not because there was I drank some water that had a little bit more lead in it than anything else. So a lot of sporadic cancers may be happening just because that's over time. And that's another reason why we see more as we get older, it would seem.
I would agree with that, yeah. It's not necessarily that there's some external factor outside of somebody's own body, this carcinogen from outside. It could be that there was an error just as a product of, as we talked about, you have a lot of genetic information that you have to replicate. Yeah.
I was thinking about that because one of the links on the program notes that we have on our website is a link with Siddhartha Mukherjee, who wrote a wonderful book on the history of cancer. And he was talking about it with the interviewer, and he made the comment is it's not going to be maybe politically acceptable, but most of our cancers that we know the cause of are probably hereditary, not environmentally linked. And that causes may cause a lot of angst for people. But the point is, we know things in cigarette smoke as we pay an ionizing radiation, but there's very few other things that we absolutely know are out there causing cancers. And yet there's some very good evidence about a lot of genetic cancers where we have the information. So yeah, it may be a lot more environmental influences, but we can't say it with as strong enough evidence as we can with the genetic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And which I thought was kind of interesting. So it made me think about, well, sporadic cancers don't have to have environmental links, which is also made me ask that question. Well, let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. Our topic today is in hereditary cancers, the genetic changes that lead to cancers. My guests are Dr. Megan Nathan. She's a genetic counselor doing just cancer genetic counseling at Providence Medical Center. And also later we're going to meet Ellen Provost, who is a survivor of a hereditary breast cancer. And she's going to tell her story. She is also an epidemiologist and works for the Alaska Native Epidemiology Center at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So give us a call or send us an email if you've got questions about today's program. So tell us a little bit about, as you use the analogy, these bricks, the heavy guys that increase our risk for problems that can happen.
Certainly, yeah. So the two best-known genes as they relate to hereditary breast cancer probably are BRCA1 and BRCA2. Angelina Jolie, back in about 2013, she made these genes famous when she had genetic testing to see if she had a change in either. Her mother had a personal history of ovarian cancer, so that's what prompted testing for Angelina. And Angelina Jolie, she was indeed found to have a BRCA1 mutation. So those are the two that we know that are probably the most well-known amongst the layperson, BRCA1 and BRCA2. And they're both tumor suppressor genes, so they normally work to prevent cancer in humans by preventing tumors from forming. BRCA1 and 2, they do this by acting as basically spell checkers for the cell. They're reading through and looking to see if there are errors that they need to fix.
So evolution has helped us try to prevent these problems by evolving ways in our cells to look for errors and then correct them. And that's one of there are several genes that do that, but BRCA1 and 2 are the ones that do it. So if they fail because they're mutated, then that increases the risk of not catching these mutations. Is that the way I understand it?
Exactly, yes. And in these particular genes, in tumor suppressor genes, this category that prevents cancer from forming by suppressing tumor growth, it's a type of mutation called a loss of function mutation. So where the protein that gene normally codes for is no longer able to carry out its function.
Mm-hmm. So you don't want that.
No, you do not want that. Yeah. And actually, speaking to redundancy and our bodies having mechanisms to try and prevent disease, so I talked about earlier how our genes, they typically come in pairs. We get one member from mom, one member from dad. So say for the BRCA1 gene, you have two members of that pair. Say you get a mutation in one copy of your BRCA1 gene, loss of function mutation in this case, your body would still be protected against from cancer in that particular cell because you have that backup copy that came from your other parent.
And that's called a heterozygote situation.
Yes, exactly. Right? When you have one working copy, one non-working copy.
Versus a homozygous if you have both. So generally, but not always, you can get by with that redundancy you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually, I'll speak to this a bit because it kind of clarifies the difference between sporadic and hereditary cancer a bit. So there's a thing called the two-hit hypothesis, and it refers to how mutations in tumor suppressor genes lead to cancer. And so in sporadic cancer, you start off with two working copies, say, of your BRCA1 gene. So if you get one hit in a single cell to one copy of your BRCA1 gene, that mutation's confined to that cell, let's say. And even with one copy of the BRCA1 gene not working, that cell still has a backup copy. So a tumor wouldn't form because you have that redundancy there. Cancer wouldn't form until you get a second hit, a second mutation in that exact same cell in the other copy of the BRCA1 gene. Mm-hmm. So it takes two hits that just happen to happen by chance and aren't caught in the same cell for sporadic cancer to occur. But in hereditary cancer, somebody, when they inherit that brick that gives them that substantial increased risk to develop cancer, in hereditary cancer, in every cell in somebody's body, they're born with a hit in one of their BRCA genes. So for them, it takes a hit in their other copy in any cell in their body. It doesn't have to be in the exact same cell. Mm-hmm. And so that's why people that inherit mutations in these genes, they have a substantially increased risk to develop cancer, but we don't say it's guaranteed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me take this line of information just a little bit further to clarify for myself and maybe for listeners. It's my understanding. Let's not talk about these inherited problems in tumor suppressor genes or other genes that increase your risk. Talk about cancer in general. Is that it seems to me that a big understanding now is it may take hits in multiple, and when we say hits, we mean mutation changes in multiple genes to eventually lead to cancer. So there may be, and again, I want you to correct me, so you get a hit in a gene that is maybe says I'm going to not control cell growth as well. So now I'm going to, instead of my cells automatically dying like all cells eventually do, I'm going to make a change in a gene that lets that cell continue to grow more. And then you have another hit later in a cell that is involved in making blood supply to cells. And because if you're going to have a lot of cell growth, you're going to need some food, and you need that to work. And then you may also have another gene hit that has to do with, well, now it's going to let that cell move through the bloodstream and set up a home in the brain mm-hmm. as a metastasis. And most cells don't do that naturally. So it's like there may require multiple hits in a bad sequence of events to really lead to cancers. And that kind of gets to the idea that it may take cancers a long time to really to develop, and that maybe even all of us are having little cancers all the time that get handled by the immune system or never develop further. Am I making myself clear, and does that make sense to, as you understand cancer?
Yeah, for the listeners, I've been nodding throughout that explanation. but it really does take kind of, regardless of whether it's hereditary or sporadic cancer, kind of the perfect storm, the perfect combinations of mutations to these genes. And mutations to your tumor suppressor genes, they just kind of tip the scale it towards the direction of tumorigenesis from the beginning. And then once that kind of process gets going, cancer can kind of, I've heard it described as cells going wild, where it's these cells that just all they can focus on is reproducing and creating and dividing and creating more cells. And when that happens, it actually kind of compounds the problem because it makes errors in DNA even more likely to occur. And then if you have your BRCA1 gene that normally is a spell checker for the cell not working, those errors, they are more likely to get propagated. And then you end up with errors within your tumor that we differentiate them between driver and passenger mutations. So you have mutations that are passengers that just as a byproduct of cells gone wild, cell growth getting out of control, you're going to get kind of meaningless mutations that are just accumulating. But it's these driver mutations that you're kind of talking about, things that influence the blood supply to the tumor, things that influence the cell's ability to do apoptosis or program cell death. Those driver mutations are what contribute to cancer progression.
It's one of the things we're all not innately good at is statistics and so forth. And this gets to the idea that what I'm hearing you say is even if you inherit these in genetic risks, it does not guarantee. There's a lot of complexity between the genetic book, the reading of the book, and the onset of disease. And so we give people percentages. We can't tell anybody that what's absolutely going to happen. Nobody's reading the future that well yet.
No, we can't look in a crystal ball, but certainly for some of these genes, there are substantial lifetime risks, so we can have a pretty good idea. But I guess the flip side of the coin as well, though, is there are people that don't have mutations in these tumor suppressor genes that get cancer in their 40s, and it's kind of just chalked up to luck of the draw, if you will.
Are there other bricks we should talk about?
Yeah, actually. So BRCA1 and 2, those are kind of the most popular, the main ones. But we actually have quite a few genes that confer a substantial risk to develop breast cancer for people that inherit changes in them. I'll cover just a few of them, the biggest of the heavy hitters. So one would be CDH1. So CDH1, it's often seen with diffuse gastric cancer and then a type of breast cancer known as lobular breast cancer, as well as some colorectal cancers. And so I bring this gene up because if, say, I'm meeting with a family and I'm seeing a substantial family history of diffuse gastric cancer or lobular breast cancer, with this gene, I would want the family to know ahead of time that if somebody's found to have a mutation in CDH1, it's recommended that they have their stomach removed prophylactically. Because the diffuse gastric cancer, it's often caught too late, and it's pretty sneaky and subtle. So in order to have, the best outcome for the patient, you weigh the thought of, should I have my stomach removed? That's a huge life decision. Or should I substantially decrease my risk to develop a pretty nasty type of cancer? Some of the other genes I'd like to talk about are P10. So this one's pretty rare. It's only 1 in 200,000 people is found to have a mutation in P10. Conversely, BRCA1 and 2, between 1 in 400 and 1 in 600 people has a mutation in either of those genes. So P10, very rare. It's causes something called Cowden syndrome. So in families where we see Cowden syndrome, we're going to see a lot of breast cancer, thyroid, uterine, and skin cancer, among other cancers. Something interesting about P10 is actually people that have mutations in this gene, they tend to have a very large head circumference. So we're talking 97th percentile and above. And then the last one that I'd like to mention with these high-risk genes is TP53. So this causes Li-Fraumeni syndrome. When we were talking about the crystal ball, this is the one that kind of gives us the best, I guess, fortune-telling ability, in that somebody that has a mutation in TP53, they actually have a 90% lifetime risk to develop any sort of cancer. So it's quite substantial and quite striking, and kind of speaks to why it's helpful to identify these people early on before they are diagnosed with cancer, to try and catch cancer early in its development, when it's more likely to be amenable to treatment, or to try and even prevent cancer.
Are those all tumor suppressor genes, just out of curiosity?
These ones that I mentioned are all tumor suppressor genes. Okay. Typically with hereditary cancer, we think of tumor suppressor genes.
So they're like BRCA in that their function is to scout out and look for errors, mutations, and do something about them?
And do something about them, yeah. Okay. BRCA1 and 2, they're spell checkers in that they read through and are looking for errors, whereas TP53, that one, it's sort of a sorting mechanism where it says, it looks at a cell and it assesses essentially the amount of mutations that are in the DNA in that cell, and it'll decide, is this repairable? Should I recruit some of the other tumor suppressor genes or other genes involved in DNA repair to this area to fix this mess? Mm-hmm. Or are we too far gone? Should I designate this cell to undergo apoptosis that programs cell death? Mm-hmm. So TP53, it has it's actually called the guardian of the genome because it's so important for delineating what DNA should we try and repair and what cells are just too far gone.
I can't help but make a comment. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but the finding that there were only about 20,000 genes in humans was a great revelation. Everybody thought there were going to be hundreds of thousands because there's hundreds of thousands of proteins. So one great enigma, one great thing to read about if you're interested in genetics is how the hell is it that 20,000 genes does all the work that we do? And we won't get into that today, but Megan's implied some things like recruiting and other genes talking to other genes and jumping over genes. It gets pretty exciting, but at least to me it does. So hopefully if other listeners are interested, you might wonder how it is that only 20,000 genes does all the work that we ask it to do. Is there a way to screen for these important genes? Are there tests that can be done?
So screening for mutations in these genes?
Yeah, screening for the genes that you want to see if somebody's inherited or not, I guess. Are there panels of blood tests, so to speak?
Yeah. So that's what we do a lot in genetic counseling, actually, is you have hereditary cancer panels where our largest panel actually has up to 90 genes on it. So 90 genes that have been implicated in hereditary cancer. And what you do is you get some DNA from the individual in question, and you would read through those genes looking for spelling errors that are basically different from our reference sequence of what we expect the code for that particular gene to look like. And if you find a spelling error in that gene, then the question becomes, is this change part of normal human variation? We all have changes in our DNA. Most of them just have to do with things that make us unique. Or is this change, is it different from our quote-unquote reference sequence that we're comparing to because it has implications for disease, be it it makes it so that this particular tumor suppressor gene can't do its job as well as we would normally hope, and does that give us an explanation for the cancer seen in that family? Mm-hmm. So we do have panels up to 90 genes for hereditary cancer, or there are also genetic tests that look at all 20,000 genes or all 20,000 genes in addition to this area of the genome called the non-coding region.
Okay. I'm going to mention one more time here before we take a break. You can reach us with questions or comments today about hereditary cancer risk, particularly breast cancer risk, if you've got questions or comments. Our local number, 550 855-850-8433. Our email address, line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1 at alaskapublic.org. And our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Ellen, or Dr. Provost, I want to bring you into this conversation a little bit. So my understanding is that you have an intimate understanding of this problem, and maybe you want to tell us why.
Yes, unfortunately I do. My story begins about 12 years ago when I first asked to be tested because I felt I was at risk due to my Ashkenazi Jewish heritage. And when I was asked about the test, they said, well, you don't have any family history. You don't really need to worry about it. And I had no mother, no grandmother, no aunts, no male relatives with any breast or ovarian cancer. So no one was concerned, and the recommendations at that time indicated that I didn't need to be tested.
But you were worried about Ashkenazi being Ashkenazi because you'd heard that...
Right. So as a physician and into prevention, I knew I was at risk, and so I asked the question.
Right. Because BRCA and BRCA2 are associated with Ashkenazi Jews. Is that the specific reason?
Yeah. So the rate of, my understanding, Megan can correct me, the rate among Ashkenazi Jewish people is much higher than the one in 400 to 600. It's actually 1 in 40 and maybe even higher, which is extremely high. So that's two and a half people for every 100 people that of Ashkenazi Jewish descent. So my story continues about 4 years after asking the question about being tested, I was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. It was then and only then that I was eventually tested because that was going to affect treatment options. The tests revealed that I was BRCA positive. How could this happen? I had no family history. So the next step was for
my... And you'd been given the wrong advice in your mind, I would think.
Well, of course, you know, there's always the what-ifs.
Yep.
So the next step was that my mom and dad were tested. My dad tested positive. Megan is much better at explaining this, but you can inherit this gene error from either parent. And although men get this mutation and are at risk, increased risk for some cancers if they have this mutation, they are not as frequently seen as they are in women. Thus, it makes it easy for this mutation to, in effect, hide for generations as it is transmitted from father to son and eventually to a daughter. Following my necessary surgeries, I had to undergo 6 months of chemotherapy and a month of radiation, and I need to continue to this day to take medication every single day to minimize the risk of my cancer returning. Mm-hmm. All of these have side effects, as you can imagine. So the chemo and the radiation could have been completely avoided had I been tested when I had originally asked. My cancer was completely preventable, or almost completely preventable. But because I did not have a personal or a family history, I did not meet the guidelines for testing. Mm-hmm. And even still to this day, the guidelines still require that you have a personal or a family history of a relevant cancer to be tested and for it to be paid for, perhaps by insurance or other payers. So that's pretty much my
story. Ferret that out a little bit. We don't always know our family history. We don't always know how our relatives died. In fact, in the past, cancer was felt to be something that shouldn't be talked about, and even patients weren't told they were dying of cancer in the past. So that requirement, when you think about it, is probably not a good one.
Well, and in fact, there's a study that I was just, there's at least one study that I know about, and there's probably more, among Ashkenazi Jewish population showed that over half of carriers do not have or know of a family history.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in preparation, I read something that men with prostate cancer, Ashkenazi Jew men that carry one of these mutations. I don't know if it's one or two or both, are at increased risk of prostate cancer. So they may have prostate cancer. We may not associate it with it, and it may never have been tested in them either. It's another reason why knowing your family history is not necessarily sufficient evidence not to be tested. So is the evidence, so what do we want to talk about now? The idea, should women, maybe men with Ashkenazi Jewish background, all be tested?
This is a tricky question. the answer for me is I think that people that are, personally from a personal standpoint, I think that people that are interested in pursuing testing, there shouldn't be these substantial barriers to them receiving testing if it's something that interests them, in particular if they have a strong family history and it seems like the suspicion going into testing is that we're going to find a mutation that could have a substantial life-saving impact for this patient.
Right.
The caveat that I feel is I want people to know what they're getting themselves into when they pursue genetic testing, and I want them to really have gone through and give an informed consent to know, is genetic testing going to be helpful for me? What will I do with this information?
And that's not as simple as it seems, and we're going to get into that in the second half of the program, I think, because there's some unknowns, and that makes life a lot more difficult, but there's always going to be unknowns.
There's always going to be unknowns.
Before we go to break, and I want to do that real quickly, Ellen, there are some educational cancer awareness programs that you guys are here to talk about as well. So why don't we do that real quickly, and then we'll go to break, and then we'll talk about it again later. I want people to hear about this.
Okay, great. Sunday, October 15th, 5 p.m. at Congregation Beth Shalom, there's going to be a community forum on breast cancer prevention, what you need to know. We're going to have a panel of experts there and some patient stories. And most important is an opportunity for you to ask your questions. There will be ample time for question and answers with our panel of experts. This event is free. It is open to the public. No RSVP is needed. There will be refreshments, and we look forward to seeing you there. A second event that I'd like to also highlight is later in the month on October 26th. It's a Thursday night starting 6 p.m. We'll have a film showing of the documentary Pink and Blue, highlighting a family's story dealing with hereditary cancer. It also emphasizes that men get breast cancer too. This event is also open to the public. It's free, and refreshments will also be provided. So we hope to see you there as well. Thank you.
Just real quickly, I did get an email that wants listeners to know there's also free tickets available for a 5:30 film premiere tonight of Partners in Healing. It's about a film from a cancer survivor. I think it's at the Beartooth. Yes, it is at the Beartooth. And it's another information about some involvement, some things that may help you with cancer. It's called Partners in Healing at the Beartooth this evening. So I just want to quickly throw that in since a listener responded or wrote with that email. So let me take a quick break. Your local number again, 550-8433, email address line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a 1 minute break, and then we'll continue our discussion on inherited cancers, particularly breast cancer, with Megan Nathan and Dr. Ellen Provost. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Anchorage Public Media here in Anchorage, Alaska, or Alaska Public Media from in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. I want to remind you that we're talking about cancers and that they are a genetic disease caused by inherited mutations or acquired mutations during the life time, perhaps sometimes due to environmental factors and sometimes just to mutations with multiple kinds of reproduction of cells that happen day to day. Errors just happen. Today we're focusing on these inherited cancers, especially breast cancer. My guests are Dr. Ellen Provost. She's an epidemiologist and director of the Alaska Native Epidemiology Center, and as you've just heard if you've been listening, she's a survivor of hereditary breast cancer. Megan Nathan is also with us today, and she's a cancer genetic counselor at Providence Alaska Medical Center. Email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number is 550-8433. And remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on a Monday evening, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. Megan, let's get into what you do a little bit more specifically, and maybe starting with things like what are the clues from the family history that might lead people to want to talk with you?
Absolutely, yeah. And I'd like to preface this, too, with these are kind of guidelines that we work off of, but as was highlighted with Ellen's story, sometimes these guidelines fail us. And it's not sometimes we do have people that have hereditary breast cancer or other hereditary forms of cancer that don't have that substantial family history. But in any event, we share our genes with our family, and that's why it makes sense that we can look to a family history for clues that is there a brick that confers an increased risk to develop cancer being passed amongst individuals. Excuse me. So some of the clues we look for are the number of people diagnosed with cancer. Cancer is unfortunately pretty common. 1 in 3 people will develop cancer in their lifetime, and breast cancer is actually the most common cancer that we see in women, with 1 in 8 women being diagnosed with breast cancer during her lifetime. So the question we ask with number is, are we seeing more cancer than we'd expect by chance, say in the women on one side of the family? I say women because although men can get breast cancer, the risks with mutations in any of these cancer-causing genes are substantially higher for women as compared to men. Another thing we look for in regard to number is, are we seeing people in the family that have multiple primary tumors, say either different cancers, first diagnosed with colon cancer and then later diagnosed with breast cancer in a single individual, or say somebody has bilateral breast cancer, so both breasts being involved, both the right and the left. We look to see age at diagnosis, so the average age for somebody to develop breast cancer is 63. So if we're seeing 50s or younger, that kind of perks our antenna and makes us wonder, is there a brick that gave this person a substantially increased risk to develop breast cancer? Other clues are going to be, are there rare cancers that we're seeing in the family history? So ovarian cancer is an example of that. Only about 1.3 to 2% of women in the general population will get ovarian cancer in their lifetime. Or another rare cancer would be male breast cancer. So as we've alluded to and we've talked about, men can get breast cancer. Just in the general population, the rate's only about 0.1%. We look to see if there are aggressive cancers. You'd mentioned prostate cancer, how that it's relatively common in the general population as men age. But say we're seeing a prostate cancer that's aggressive, has a high Gleason score, was diagnosed in a younger man, then that would make us more suspicious. And then with the autosomal dominant inheritance that we talked about earlier, we're looking to see, are there multiple generations of people affected? Are we seeing grandma had breast cancer, mom had breast cancer, a sister had ovarian cancer? Are we seeing this brick that's being passed between generations? And then the last thing is, we're looking to see, are there different constellations of cancers that we typically think of as coming in an association in certain syndromes? So with BRCA1 and 2, we're typically talking about breast and ovarian cancer. For BRCA2, there's also risk for melanoma, prostate cancer, and male breast cancer. And then some of those other genes we talked about, CDH1, how there's that diffuse gastric cancer and lobular breast cancer and colorectal cancer. So we'll look to see, is there a suspicious pattern of the types of cancers that we're seeing in a family?
We have a caller, and I think I'd like to take that call, and then we'll continue to understand a little bit more about what you do at a visit, Megan.
Absolutely.
Tracy, you're on line one.
Hi there. I have a familial history of colorectal cancer. My great-grandfather died of colorectal cancer. My paternal grandmother died of colorectal cancer, and my father has had 2 bouts of colorectal cancer. I was told this last summer that I did need to be tested. Now, with me, I've definitely got a family history. Two questions. One, do I still need to be tested, or should I just, you know, go for it and realize it's probably going to happen and be proactive about getting colonoscopies, et cetera? My other question is, if they test me and find this gene, how long until my insurance company decides this is a pre-existing condition
right.
and cancels my insurance? I know
right.
officially right now it's illegal,
right.
but you know it's coming.
Right. Maybe not. I mean, yeah, I understand the question. All right, I'm going to let Megan answer those questions.
Okay, gotcha. And remind me, I think we've got two questions here, or three maybe even.
So the first one is, I've got a family history, like three generations strong.
Mm-hmm.
Still need to be tested.
And you yourself have not developed, you do not have colorectal cancer yourself, though. It's just family members at this stage?
But I have 3 years until my doctor has recommended that I first get tested. And it is earlier than the recommended, I don't remember, 60 or something.
Yeah, so when you talk about testing, you're talking about two different things. Sometimes, should I get genetic testing? And the other thing is, should I start screening, colorectal screening tests?
Right? Well, I'm going to be getting screened early.
Okay.
Should I still get screened, even though I have a very strong, should I get genetically tested?
Right. Gotcha. Gotcha.
History.
Okay.
Yeah. So first disclaimer would be worth talking with a genetics professional in person who can give you more tailored advice and ask more pointed questions about the family history. I would say you are a candidate for genetic testing, and if it's something that interests you, that is an option. Not everybody that is a candidate for it wants to pursue genetic testing, and so another option would be to get your colonoscopies at the intervals that your healthcare provider recommends in order to have that assurance of, knowing you're being proactive about screening, but not everybody wants to know this genetic information. And then a caveat with genetic testing, though, the reason I asked, have you yourself been diagnosed with colorectal cancer, is the most helpful person to test for these hereditary cancer syndromes is an affected individual oftentimes. And this just helps us with interpreting the result of the genetic test. So say your father was to have genetic testing and was found to have a mutation, and if we're talking about colorectal cancer, we might be thinking about a condition called Lynch syndrome. So say he was found to have Lynch syndrome through genetic testing, and we knew the exact change in his, we'll do MLH1 gene that explains why he developed colorectal cancer. Then we're able to test you for that very mutation, and it becomes a simple yes or no question. We have an explanation for the family history of cancer, and now the question is, did you inherit that same mutation? If yes, that's a positive result, and we would be able to manage your risk for cancer with increased screening and surveillance or different other medical management options. Or the question is, did you not inherit that mutation? There's a 50% chance. So your dad, he has two copies of his MLH1 gene, for example. One of them works, and one of them is a non-working copy with a mutation. If you inherit the working copy, then that would be a negative result, and you would go back down to the general population risk, we would say, for colorectal or other associated cancers. And so we would have a clearer picture of your cancer risk. If we test you, this is the other scenario where, say, we, rather than testing an affected individual, testing your father, and we test you, if we get back a negative result for you, we don't know if, had we tested dad, we would have gotten back a positive result, and you are a true negative. We can't basically determine if you're a true negative, because we've run the risk.
Dad tested too?
Well, if afterwards we got your dad tested, then we could maybe have a better picture of what's going on. But we get the most clear answer if we're able to identify a mutation in an affected individual, and then we do cascade testing from there of other family members.
One last question.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Will the insurance company pay for him and for me to be tested? Or will it be something where I am forced to pay for his testing so that I have information about my own health?
If your father went and saw a genetics professional and had his own appointment, if he meets testing criteria, which would probably depend on the age of diagnosis for the colorectal cancer for him, then he could have genetic testing, and then he's able to share his results with you. And since you would have then a 50% risk of also inheriting, say he has a positive result, he's found to have a mutation, then I can't say for certain because I'm not an insurance company, but majority should pay for the cascade testing for you. It's called single site analysis, where we're just looking, yes or no, did you inherit that same change from your dad?
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think the more information we have, the easier it is to make decisions. The more information we have, it's the easier it is for physicians to help patients get insurance coverage for information as well. The question may come up, well, why doesn't everybody? Why don't we just test everybody for everything? And that gets into this issue, a lot of tough issues, some of which we may not even get time to talk about, but I want to make it clear that it gets into the when do we do mammograms, when do we do prostate screening, and what's the advantages. There are sometimes false positives. There's things that happen to people that don't answer the question, or they make it more complicated. We spend more money. We have complications of the investigation. So somewhere you have to draw a line who should be what. But those are guidelines, and that with each individual situation, it's worth talking about it with a professional about whether or not you might be someone who still should have the screening or the testing outside of the guidelines, because there are definitely individual situations, and all these are guidelines. They're not absolute.
That's exactly right. For some of these, we do have more clear-cut guidelines that the NCCN, they're just a national cancer institute, essentially, that has created guidelines to delineate who we should offer BRCA1 and 2 testing to. But for other genes, we don't have as clear-cut guidelines, and it's often left up to clinician judgment. Or, you know, there are, I think it would be helpful to talk about, there are self-pay options for people who might not meet some of these stricter guidelines, but would like to pursue genetic testing on their own, even without insurance covering it.
I had an email that says, I've recently utilized 23andMe, which is a commercial genetic testing thing. I've learned more about my genetics. Can genetic counseling help me to understand the results, especially variants?
So 23andMe is a little bit tricky in that they don't really do genetic testing. They do something, what's referred to as genotyping. So with clinical genetic testing, we're reading through every base pair or the base pairs within a gene one by one. With genotyping, you're essentially looking for abbreviations throughout the genome that allow you to infer things like somebody might be at an increased risk for to snore. They have whimsical traits for 23andMe. It's not necessarily things that you would have ordered for you by a healthcare provider.
There's some regulations about that because it really, as I hope people are getting, this is a complex issue. It requires a lot of information for people to make good response, good answers. And these small commercial things, it might be great in telling you what your ancestry is, but when we start talking about cancer risk, genetic risk, and so forth of certain things, it's, I think they're actually cannot do that. I think it's
FDA
required
took that away.
They have to be able. It's because it's these are tough decisions, and people could start doing things that they really don't need to do based on a misunderstanding. So, anyway, so how's this? What does it cost? What kind of testing is usually done? Is it a blood test or sputum or what? And then what's the cost?
So typically we do a blood draw, but you can also do a saliva sample if we have a patient that, you know, just has a very big phobia of needles. The way the saliva sample works is you take a buccal swab and you collect cells from the inside of a person's cheek, and those cells, they contain DNA. The caveat to the saliva sample is sometimes you don't get enough DNA, so I do recommend, if it's not a huge inconvenience for somebody, that we do blood draw because it's a little bit more reliable. And then really you can do everything from single site analysis, which is where there's a known mutation that's been identified in another family member, and you're just testing an individual for that particular mutation, and it's that yes or no. Or you can do anything from a couple genes if you have just a couple disorders that you're suspicious of to the big 90, the big guns, the 90 gene panel. And it's really just the amount of uncertainty that a patient is willing to put on their shoulders, I guess, as they pursue this testing really dictates how big of a panel we pursue.
How much trouble have you personally had about getting insurance to participate in the payment? I realize that there's deductibles, there's all kinds of things, but generally that just getting insurance to agree that this is something that should have some coverage from insurance.
Typically, I have not had very much difficulty. We have those guidelines that we go based off of, and if somebody meets that guidelines, typically insurance will cover it. Mm-hmm. The genetic testing company, the way it works is they interface with somebody's insurance provider, and typically people won't, if they meet guidelines, they won't have a bill greater than $100, and a lot of the companies, they have a policy, if you get a bill greater than $100, call them and they'll work with you to lower it.
So there's a lot of barriers to getting the health care in our country, and one of them's money, one of them's access, one of them's education, so forth. But let's not let money be the issue, is what I hear you say.
Yeah, especially if there is, you know, cause for concern. And, you know, these tests, if they're not covered by insurance on their own, they can be on the order of thousands of dollars. So that can be pretty prohibitive. Yep. But there are cheaper self-pay options that are available that range from $99 to $475. Okay. And they range in terms of the number of genes on the panel and then to a certain degree the quality of the lab that you're going with. So
gotcha.
These options there are available, and $475, that's certainly not cheap. But for some people, it would feel like the right course of action. If insurance isn't going to cover this and I still want to pursue genetic testing, it is an option for them.
Millie, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi, I'm 76 years old. I've had mammograms for the last 40 years. And I can't get a straight answer if I still need to do that or not.
I don't think any of us here today are exactly experts and can answer that question. So I hate to not give you another square answer. I can tell you if you were to call your primary care physician or someone who could look up quickly, there are some guidelines on that. But again, the guidelines would be for the typical patient. If there's a family history, if you've had other particular problems, other cancers, you may well need to continue to do breast cancer screening. Ellen, do you know the answer? My feeling is at 76, you're probably not typically a candidate to continue with breast cancer screening. But
yeah, and I'd have to look it up.
Yeah. So
things
there are
change.
None of us are prepared to be able to give you that. And I do think certainly one of the cancer, breast cancer, any of the cancer offices, somebody should be able to give you that answer specifically, Millie.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks for the call.
Bye-bye.
Ellen, let's talk about the programs that you wanted to make sure people were aware of one more time before we lose time.
Absolutely. So Sunday, October 15th, a community forum on breast cancer prevention, opportunity for you to ask questions of a panel of subject matter experts. We're going to have a breast radiologist, a breast surgeon, a GYN surgeon, and, of course, our cancer genetics counselors there. We'll have some patient stories and, again, ample time for you guys to ask your questions. So I really encourage everyone who wants to learn more to come to that event. Again, Sunday, October 15th. And then at the end of the month, October 26th, the film showing at the Wilda Marston at the Anchorage Public Library called Pink and Blue, a documentary. We'll also have the producer there afterwards to answer questions about the making of this film. Thank you, Thad.
All right. We have about 5 minutes left, and I don't have any more phone calls or emails, so I want to use this time as judiciously as possible. One of the problems, and I want to have time, particularly Megan, for you to give us some final comments. I like doing that. But one of the problems that may happen and makes giving genetic counseling and making decisions about information you get is that sometimes we get information that is maybe not particularly what we want to hear. And one of them that I know comes up is, let's say you do some genetic testing and a term comes back that, yes, you have a gene, but you have a variant of the gene of uncertain significance. What does that mean? How often does that happen? And why does it complicate the decisions for families?
Yeah, so variant of uncertain significance. Something that I have learned in my genetics career, basically, is that very rarely are things clear-cut black and white. And a variant of uncertain significance, it's basically a question mark result. It's a gray area where we just don't have enough information yet to say definitively whether a change in a gene causes cancer has implications for health in that it causes a substantial increased risk to develop cancer. That would be a pathogenic variant. In the middle, you have this variant of uncertain significance where we don't know if it's disease-causing or if it's part of normal human variation. Normal human variation just being benign variants, things that just make each of us unique. We all have changes in our DNA.
Right.
Most of them don't have implications for disease. So this variant of uncertain significance, it falls into this gray area of we don't know quite. Most of them, they get reclassified, if I'm being honest, mm-hmm. into being part of normal human variation, things that don't have implications for disease. But mm-hmm. because we don't know what they mean currently, we don't test other family members for these variants. And some clues, though, that when we're looking at a change in a gene that we use to figure out, is it disease-causing or is it benign, are going to be its incidence in our population databases. So we actually have population databases that have individuals from all different ethnic backgrounds, their genetic information, their code, and their sequence. And we're able to look and see, okay, we found a change in a gene. Let's look at our database. Is it sufficiently rare in that database, or are we seeing it at like a 1% frequency, in which case we'd call it a polymorphism, part of normal human variation. We have computer programs that we use. They're called in silico models to try and predict the effect of the genetic change on the protein. So we'll, in addition to the population database info, we'll look at those computer-based models. We'll look at the literature to see if we're seeing, is this change seen oftentimes in cases, people that have cancer, and it's not often seen in controls, healthy individuals that don't develop cancer, and we'll compare the incidence in each of those populations. And then we have big repositories or databases that have variants that different genetic testing laboratories have looked at. And so you're able to look at those databases and see, has any other lab seen this change before? If so, what are they saying about it? And then together, hopefully, you're able to reclassify a variant from being a question mark to either on the side of benign, just part of normal human variation, or pathogenic, disease causing a positive result, where there might be implications for a patient's medical management if they're found to have one of these variants of uncertain.
This is really an exploding field in the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years. And so what we know today is not what's going to be known tomorrow. And if you listening to the program or you want to re-listen to it or have family members listen to it, listen and spread that information about situations where it may sound like it's worthwhile that you sit down with a genetic counselor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a side comment I'd like to make if we have time. For people that are found to have these variants of uncertain significance, it is worthwhile to follow up with the lab periodically or a genetic counselor periodically to see, has this variant been reclassified?
What do you want people to remember from this program?
I would say one of our taglines that Ellen and I were talking about was know your risk. So know your family history, know what personal risk factors you might have that might predispose you to develop cancer, be them hereditary risk factors or different things about your personal history and your the environment you're exposed to. So really don't be afraid to talk to family members about their histories of cancer, your family's history of cancer, so that you can be in a position to advocate for yourself. And then something to reiterate, though, a majority of cancer falls into that sporadic cancer category. 70% of cancer is just acquired changes, kind of crummy luck of the draw. It's only 5 to 10% of the time that we find hereditary cancer. But for the people that fall into that category, knowing that information can have a really big impact on their health and can save lives.
All right. Yes.
Can I make sure to do an extra special thank you to our sponsors, Alaska Cancer Partnership, ANTHC, Let Every Woman Know, the LUSAC Public Library, Providence Cancer Center, and Spring Hill Suites. Thank you.
All right. Next week, Line One will be co-hosted by Prentice Pemberton, and he's going to talk about children and pornography, so why not join him Monday, October 9th at 2 p.m. My thanks to Eric Bork, who is today's audio engineer. He's also our web editor. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.